doing a record over electrics. There's Jack Holtzman there and Alex Hasselin. I remember those two guys. Jack Holtzman was an Elektra executive, and Alex Hasselin was a producer. The musical director and the guy who actually composed the stuff was Mort Garson. I don't know if you know all these names. Back then, in Hollywood, these were people who were right at the heart of the small music business, such as it was. The record was called Zodiac Cosmic Sounds. And if you play the record, you'll hear that the very first sound on the very first cut is this big fat 10 note chord that glides up. Da, da, da. You know, people back then had never heard a sound like that. You know, a 10 note gliding chord. So it starts off, the first cut is called Aries. And starts off. Da, da, da. And then the guitars and the percussion comes in. This is it again. And then boom, low note, boom. And the narrator comes on. A little guy, a little skinny guy with this big, deep, oily voice. And he says, nine times the color red explodes like heated blood. The battle's on. And, the whole thing's like that. And here I am, this nerdy engineer from the East Coast, born and brought up in New York City, being surrounded by all these record executives, West Coast. And, I was a skinny kid, not anymore, but I was then, and these record executives were not skinny, and they had these shirts. They didn't wear undershirts, which was a the East Coast, we wear undershirts. They didn't wear undershirts. They had these big, fat, gold amulets on. And they were dancing around the place, and they were saying, oh, man, this is real head music. It's funny talking like this in Hate Street. Oh, man, every head in the world's going to have to buy this record. And I don't think every head bought it. Maybe a few heads bought it. Today it just sounds so corny, but how the use of analog synthesizers, our analog synthesizers, began here on the West Coast. So I talked about things like that, once Switched on Bach came out, which was a year after Zodiac Cosmic. Then people understood that, you could make music that was really good by anybody's standards, completely on Moog synthesizer. And in 1969, my company back then was very busy building these big modular systems for all the record company people who wanted to make their hit Moog record for 1969. And that came to an end in 1970. And in order to move on, we designed the original classic Mini Moog. And shortly after that, our company became a division of Norlin Music. Norlin doesn't exist today. But back then, it was the largest manufacturer of musical instruments in the United States. They made Gibson, they made Maestro effects, they made Lowry organs, they made Storyphone pianos. They sold Pearl drums. Big, big company. And Moog Music became the electronics manufacturing arm for all their electronic products except home organs. You know, that included the all the guitar amps they sold, the SG, the Lab Series amps, all the Moog stuff, all the Maestro effects, all that stuff. And at its height, the Moog Music division of Norlin had 300 employees and, you know, made some very high quality electronic stuff that's still, you know, out there being used. So those were the early days. The company is much smaller now. Norlin doesn't exist anymore at all. I got back the ownership of the registration of the Moog Music trademark about 2 years ago. That's, you know, that's a story that has mostly to do with spending money on lawyers. It doesn't have much to do with music at all. You know, I'm back designing stuff, have been for the last 10 years. And our company, like Robot Speak, is a small independent company. I'm just very happy to be here because retailers like Robot Speak, who, you know, are managed and staffed by really knowledgeable guys who understand the musical instrument business, are what we need to show our show and service our products. So that's a long answer to your question, what did I tell the people at Mills College?
You know, you're talking about the early days. You know, particularly with like Buchla and all the stuff going on the East Coast and the West Coast. Somewhere on Divisadero was the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And I, to this day, cannot find out exactly where the location of that place was. Do you have any, idea where it was?
No, I had no contact with them in the early days.
Got it.
I found out about Buchla and the San Francisco Tape Music Center, you know, by reading about them in occasional accounts in the newspaper. You know, Buchla was some faraway guy who was doing something similar to what I was, but not exactly what I was. You know, Morton Subotnick was an important figure at the early San Francisco Tape Music Center. And I've met Morton Subotnick any number of times. He's one of these really funny guys, like Rick Wakeman, you know. They start talking, and as soon as they start talking, you start laughing, and it keeps right up. Moore told a story about, you know, when the San Francisco Tape Music Center was first getting started in the 60s, they were constantly being shut down by the police, and you know, one day the some cop came in and he said, "All right, you know, he said, wait, you know, where's the stuff? Where's the drugs? Because you know, the neighbors were reporting him, and somebody said." There's no drugs here. We're musicians. We're getting ready for a show. And the cop said, "Yeah." Is that what you're doing? He said, "Yeah." And you know, they played a little bit. And he said, the cop said, "This is what Morton." He said, "Gosh, I play accordion. Do you think I could?
So there were weird times. You know, there were stories like that. Everybody who was making music back then has a story like that.
Besides Wendy and Morton, who else? Who are some of the other musicians that you think really pushed the envelope in the early days for with Moog?
Well, Morton Zvotnik did four records or three records? He did Sidewinder, he did The Silver Apples of the Moon, he did
Wild Bull.
The Wild Bull.
Yeah.
You know, those are, they didn't sell like Switched On Bach, but everybody who was interested in electronic music had to listen to them. They were very influential. And of course, with the Buchla modular systems of the time, you could really do things you couldn't do with a keyboard. All the sequencers and the random generators and all those touch surfaces enable you to put the kind of thing that Mork was doing together. So there was a whole school of composition here, of which Buchla was a very important part. And Buchla himself is a musician, of course. He does a lot of performance in addition to developing hardware. Who else was out here? I'm thinking Pauline Oliveros was out here. Yeah.
So actually, Search Modular was set up right across the street. It's back in the day. Right above the Memphis Minis Barbecue, which is right across the street.
What about Bernie Krause, or was he later? Did he come in later?
He was. He and Paul Beaver, our first representative, were partners, and they did several records together with Moog stuff. But I don't know if Bernie ever did anything with Buchla stuff. But, the two of them together had their effect, too. But I don't think that you would say they were quite as innovative as what Subotnick did. That they weren't as radical. Maybe they were as innovative, but they weren't as radical. On the East Coast... there was an awful lot going on in the universities. George Rockberg at the University of Pennsylvania. There was a guy by the name of Andrew Rudin who got a record on Nonesuch of some of his stuff. He was at the Philadelphia Musical Academy, which is now called the University of the Arts. Dave Borden, who is a very good friend of ours, lived in the Ithaca area. He had a group called Mother Mallard's Portable Masterpiece Company. And they played on analog synthesizers. They did live performance. It's very good stuff, and it's more popular today than it was then. They were really ahead of their time. Everybody contributed a little bit. Gordon Mumma and Bob Ashley and that school. Gordon was a, I don't know if he was at UC Santa Cruz then or what. Who else? Gosh, with so many people. I haven't thought too much about all the music that was made back then. But, things were really crazy. There were people at Bell Labs was sort of a hotbed of performance art happening, they call them happenings. There were just use of technology to do artistic things. So some of them were music, some of them were dance.
Our first customer, Alwyn Nikolai, was a choreographer. Yeah, Alwyn Nikolai dance troupe. It was, they did very abstract stuff. The dancers got dressed up in these abstract costumes. The music, Nikolai composed himself on tape recorders. One of the things he used was one of our modular systems. Yeah.
What would you do with them?
Whenever they wanted something special or they wanted to buy some new stuff, they would make contact with us somehow, call up or stop by. We weren't that far from New York City, 6 hours by bus. And we talk about what we could do for them.
Did you make music with instruments?
No. I had very little to do with the actual music making. I was the technical support. I was the tool maker. Yeah.
How did you first become interested in electronic music, and specifically the theremin? What were the circumstances around that?
Okay, you have to understand what the music scene was like back then. That was 50 years ago, even longer, in fact. And I was a teenager. I was a nerd. I was going to Bronx Science High School in New York. And I loved electronics. That was my idea. Everybody else was out playing baseball or beating each other up, here I was making electronic stuff, simple stuff with vacuum tubes, with my father, and it was a fairly popular hobby back then, more than it is today. There were magazines that catered to do-it-yourself electronics hobbyists, and one of them, Radio News, published an article on how to build a theremin. That got me going. It turns out that theremin has always been a popular do-it-yourself project. The first do-it-yourself theremin article I ever saw, somebody showed to me, was in a German magazine from 1932, which was a few years after the theremin was brought to the United States. So I got into the theremin because it just intrigued me as a technical thing that needs sound. And I had some musical training at the time, and there's just something about working with sound and with circuits that made sound that I really liked. I don't think I could say any more than that. And I kept it up all through high school. I was known in high school as a kid who makes theremins. By the time I was a sophomore in college, I had written an article, my own do-it-yourself article on how to build a theremin, published in 1954, and from that I got orders, and my father and I had this little part-time business making theremins one at a time. It was just, this much more than a hobby. I certainly had no business experience. Didn't understand at all what the musical possibilities of the theremin were, because most of the people we came in contact with, this will show you how different things were back then. Most of the people who contacted us played religious music. They were, a lot of them were Midwestern. I actually had a representative who himself was a minister and used to go around from church to church putting on these little sermons with musical accompaniment. And the theremin was one device he used. And he sold 20 or 30 handmade theremins that we made to people like himself. And most of them were in the Midwest. He was based in Michigan City, Indiana. Now, keep in mind that at that time, theremin was completely shut off from the Western world. It was the Soviet Union. It was the Cold War. And this was right around this time. If you read, if you read Thurman's the story of Thurman, it's a very good book out, incredibly well written book called Thurman, Ether Music and Espionage, and the author is Albert Linsky. Now, you laugh at the word espionage. You know, Theremin was a brilliant designer when he was in his 20s. He designed the space control instrument. You know, this is in the days when electronics and vacuum tubes were completely new. And as time went on, he designed a lot of other things. Theremin was the first person to develop color TV. During the Cold War, we used to, you know, we United States citizens, we engineers used to laugh because every now and then, you know, we'd hear over the radio that the Russians claimed to be the first to invent color TV, or the first to invent this and the first to invent that. And we used to snicker at that, ha ha ha, you know, those pinko communies, you know, all they can do is lie about, you know, when they were first. I'm here to tell you that most of the things they told us back then were true. And, it, you know, it's been documented very carefully now that of all the people in the world working on color TV, Thurman was ahead of all of them. So that, you know, that's the kind of a technical mind the guy had. Why is his biography called Ether Music and Espionage? After the Second World War, he was given an award by Joseph Stalin, the, you know, the head of the Soviet Union at the time, and he had a job working for the KGB. That's like, you know, the Russian FBI. I just wondered whether I should tell you the whole story or let you read the book. I'll tell you the whole story. It's really amazing. Thurman, among other things, he invented the bug. He designed a bug. You know, you think of anything electronics. In order for it to work, it has to have a battery, right? So how do you bug the American embassy in Moscow? You know, if you get something in there, how do you replace the battery? Well, Thurman designed a bug that didn't require a battery.
I think you should explain he didn't do any of this voluntarily. He was a slave scientist.
Oh. Okay.
There it is. Okay.
I must have hit this by accident.
The ghost of the Thurman.
Yeah, throughout the Second World War, Thurman was in jail in the Soviet Union. And, you know, he basically designed what they told him to design. And, in fact, most of the great scientists in the Soviet Union were in jail during the Second World War because the Soviet government wanted to make sure they'd be there when they were needed. But this was after the Second World War. Thurman designed a completely passive device. Passive means it doesn't take any juice. What it looked like was a pack of a cigarette pack, something that big, with a pencil sticking out of it. Can you imagine that? And this was made out of metal, conductive. It turned out to resonate electrically at 300 megahertz, which is you know, back then it was a fairly high frequency. The sides of the cigarette pack part of it were very thin, so they vibrated when there were sound waves in the room, and that changed the resonant frequency of this thing. And it turns out if you bounced high frequency radio waves off it, what bounced off would be modulated by the audio. So as long as there was something beaming 330 megahertz at this thing, it acted like a little radio transmitter transmitting the sound in the room. So that was a device, you know, I told you about how big it is. A cigarette plus a half a pencil. They put that in a carved Great Seal of the United States inside, and it was presented to the American ambassador by a group of Soviet Boy Scouts. And the American ambassador hung it up. This is the honest truth. You know, it's documented. The American ambassador put it up on the wall over his desk, and for several years that thing was used by the KGB to listen in to what was going on in the American ambassador's office. They had a powerful transmitter across the street in a separate building beamed at this thing, and then they had another sensitive receiver farther down the street that would pick up what was reflected. And it was discovered, after years and years of being up there. I forgot how many years, but it was several years. The American ambassador finally discovered it. They showed it, to various experts in England and the United States. The British Home Service set up a laboratory to figure out how it worked. It was very clever. And it took them 6 months. A whole group of technicians worked for 6 months to figure out how it worked. And the CIA set up a facility too, and they never did figure out how it worked.
So we were that far behind.
We were behind terribly. I mean, this is one person's brilliant idea, in the 50s. This is the kind of mind the guy had. But Thurman did all this without any knowledge at all of the Western world. And in fact, people who knew Thurman when he was in this country during the 1930s had completely lost track of him. Someone who knew him very well, Clara Rockmore, the great Thurmanist Clara Rockmore, didn't know whether he was alive or dead. Finally, in the 1960s, this is so bizarre. I can remember this because it was in the New York Times. The New York Times music critic, Harold Schoenberg, got permission to go to Moscow to catch up on the music scene in the Soviet Union. He was being shown around the Moscow Conservatory, and the director of the conservatory was introducing him to the important people there. And as it turns out, Thurman at that point was connected with the conservatory informally. He had a small laboratory up in the attic. And he had several students who were working with him on developing instruments like this. It was not an official part of the conservatory program at all. It was something that the conservatory people tolerated.
So Harold Schoenberg's there being shown around, and here comes Leon Thurman down the hall. And Schoenberg's jaw dropped. And he looked at Thurman, and he said, "You're alive." And Thurman says, "Yes, I'm alive." And Thurman arranged for Harold Schoenberg to come up, and, you know, Thurman showed him what he was doing. Schoenberg came back, and I remember seeing this article in the New York Times. Schoenberg wrote a long article about his visit to the Moscow Conservatory. 90% of the article was about what Thurman was doing. When that article got back to the directors of the conservatory, they had a cow. They, you know, the fact that this eccentric old engineer up there who makes these strange electronic instruments got all this attention was more than they could bear, and they threw him out, and they broke up all the instruments in his laboratory, and that was the end of.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, now all this is documented. I'm not exaggerating any of this. At least that was we knew then that Thurman was still alive and, in fact, was still developing electronic musical instruments. One thing this meant is that, for most of my younger days, Thurman was a mythical figure for me. I read about him. Nobody knew that much about him. He was just a little bit like Edison, a little bit like I don't know. He was sort of a presence out there in the technical universe, you know. He was not quite a real person to me. And I never heard anybody play a theremin until these people who wanted to use the theremin for religious music came around. And is this going? Which input would this be? Okay, that's good. So, the kind of music they play would be something like this. Sliding up and down. And I thought, okay, that's, you know, that's the theremin. Finally, when I was well into making these things for money, somebody sent me a tape, a reel-to-reel tape, recorded off the radio, WQXR. Clara Rockmore had been interviewed and had played theremin live, and of course it was a lot more than this. It was virtuoso theremin playing to the highest musical standards, and that made me want to meet Clara. I finally met her in the 60s. She was still concertizing the instrument that theremin made for her was still working, and I had the bad judgment to show up with one of our instruments with a small built-in speaker, and it just didn't sound like the instrument she had with this big 15-inch speaker in a baffle behind her. You know, it was I didn't know how to present a theremin with a decent sound system.
And she sort of blew me away. She said, you know, basically come back when you, you know, when you got this thing happening. And the next time I met Clara was around 1969 or 1970. We were making synthesizers. The Museum of Modern Art asked us to build equipment for a concert, a Jazz in the Garden concert, part of their series. The garden that was the garden of the museum, big sculpture garden, and this concert that we built, performance modular performance synthesizers for, there were 4,000 people attending it. 4,000 people in a sculpture garden, and they were standing shoulder to shoulder like this through the whole thing. At the end, when it was all over, Clara and her sister came up to me, that they were in the audience, and she was very excited that, you know, here electronic instruments were being enthusiastically received, and she thought it was about time for the theremin to be enthusiastically received, because it too was electronic and it was modern and it was space controlled. And that led to us talking about her making a record. So there's a CD out now. It came out first as on vinyl, but it's a CD now. Clara Rockmore's playing. I produced it. Clara and her sister Nadia are the performers, and it's an outstanding record of Clara's performance technique. Yeah.
How did Raymond Scott influence your designs? I read somewhere that when you were younger, you used to visit his facility out in the ocean.
How many of you know about Raymond Scott? Yeah, let me tell you what I knew about him, you know, when I was a teenager. There was a program on the radio called the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. And every week, it was a half an hour program of the top 10. The house band for that show was the Raymond Scott Orchestra, and the chick singer for that was Raymond Scott's wife, Dorothy Collins. So, you know, he was very well known publicly as being a leader of the Raymond Scott Orchestra. He also had a performance group called the Raymond Scott Quintet, which had six musicians in it. And Raymond wrote the music for them and rehearsed them. It was very fast-moving, very precise stuff that you associate these days with cartoons, because the music wound up being sold to companies that make the cartoons. So that, you know, Raymond Scott made a lot of money on that stuff, and he had this mansion right outside of New York City. It was four stories high, and, you know, big house. Really big. It had an elevator going, you know, up and down. The entire basement of the house was Raymond Scott's playground. He loved fooling around, building stuff. He had one very large room with every machine tool on the planet in it. You know, he could make anything he wanted out of metal. Had another one with every woodworking tool on the planet in it. He had a third one with a complete electronics shop. He could make anything electronic. Mm-hmm. Then he had this enormous room with equipment racks in it, you know, 19-inch racks, where he was building electronic stuff and stuff using relays and switches and motors. It was all hooked up to make sounds and to sequence it. One of the types of switches he uses is called a stepper relay. They used to be fairly common in telephones that when you dialed an 8 on a dial phone, off in the central office, there'd be one of these stepper relays and it'd go click, 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 like that. And that's how, you know, the eight got switched in. So, you know, there were all these racks filled with switches and relays and motors and things that went around, like a timer in a washing machine, and just going around like this, make contact as they went around. And these were his sequencers. You know, it was Buchla's idea of sequencers and various timing devices that he has is very similar to what Scott did, but Scott did it all electromechanically. You know, electronics was not as advanced back then. It was all vacuum tubes. So the way I got to see Scott's house was that he called up one day and ordered a theremin. My father and I made him a theremin, very nice theremin. That particular model had a rather elaborate pitch antenna. And my father and I brought it out to him, and that's when Raymond Scott showed us around the place. And I first got to see all this stuff. He didn't say anything about why he wanted a theremin. So my father and I drove home. A couple of months later, we get a call from Raymond Scott again, inviting us to come out and see what he did with our theremin. We came out, and there's a theremin sitting on a table with the pitch antenna cut off. attached to it was this keyboard with a mechanical arrangement along the backs of the keys consisting of a light vane. It was made out of very light balsa wood. When you push the key down, the vane would go up. The higher the key, the more the vane would go up, see? So then what he had was that the vane was spaced from a metal plate. That whole business was connected in place of the antenna. So instead of going like this, this vane went like this, and that's how it was played. His idea was that you could glide. Here was a keyboard instrument where you could glide from note to note by playing one note, one key, and then the other, and letting go of this one. You could go, and he called that the Scott Clever Box, and he patented it. And then he proceeded to try to design it so it could actually be manufactured. And he had plans for it to become a very big musical instrument product. In fact, it never did get to be manufacturable, and I think two or three are in existence. There's an engineer by the name of Dave Amels, who I just saw at the show here, who has one of these things and is maintaining it. I don't know where the other two are. But after that, Raymond Scott kept in touch with me. And when we began to make modular circuits, he would call up every now and then and order special circuits to do very specific things. He never told us how he was going to use these. He just wanted the circuit to do this and that. By that time, we were living about 250 miles from New York City. Scott had split with Dorothy Collins. The four-story mansion got sold, and he was living in an industrial space where he had all his tools and whatnot, and one little living quarters at the end of it. Sort of a, you know, a piddler's dream. Well, it turns out that what he was doing with all these circuits that he hired me to design and build for him is that they were going into a big, big instrument that he was designing, I think for Motown, called the Scott Electronium. It was supposed to be, you know, it does everything. I never saw or heard the Scott Electronium. Other people have. Apparently, Motown had it for a while and then never did manage to figure out how to use it musically. Well, you know, the more complex something it is, the more challenge it is to use musically. You have to know how to think about these things. The Motown folks, of course, they had access to anything they wanted. And I don't think the Electronium figured that highly in the music they produced. That's what I know about Raymond Scott. To the end, he was always a little paranoid. He was always a little bit eccentric. As time went on, he was less and less able to support himself in style, and he died a fairly poor person.
I hear the Electronium is still around.
Yeah, I heard it too. I don't know anything about it. That's the Electronium.
Speaking of Scott's, are you aware of what's up with, I think his name was Tom Scott, the guy that used to work for you and develop the Micromoog?
Oh, Jim Scott.
Jim Scott, I'm sorry. Is he still in designing stuff? Or?
No. No, Jim lives... somewhere in the mountains of New Mexico. For a long time now, he's been interested in low water agriculture. And
quite a change.
Yeah, yeah. He's a very intelligent, very thoughtful guy. And at some point in the 70s, he did that. I hear from him every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I even went to the groups. He's with a group, a small group up there, working on that sort of thing. I even visited their website. Interesting.
Well, I worked for Moog Music for a while, and he was my boss at the end. So
really?
Yeah. I worked in the service department, and yeah. I had a lot of good times with him. He was quite a guy.
Yeah.
Sorry to keep asking you questions.
That's what I'm here for.
I'm curious to know how you feel about analog electronics and why you've chosen to continue to produce analog instruments.
I feel that I should have a well thought out, well pat answer for that now, because everybody's interested in that. There are a lot of answers. One is that I've been doing analog electronics now for 50 years, and I know pretty well how to make stuff that sounds good. The downside of analog electronics, of course, is that it's expensive today. As digital electronics is developed more and more, computer and so on,
the hardware you need to make a given sound becomes cheaper and cheaper, so that on my Macintosh laptop, which I bought less than a year ago, I paid less than $1,000 for, I can make a lot of different sounds. However, the sounds themselves coming from numbers and you know, put together with filters and you know, level control circuitry and so on, that is very different from the sort of thing you have in analog instruments. There's a difference that is easy to hear. If you have a line that's fast moving where the sounds don't last too long, and it's buried in with a lot of other stuff, it may not be easy to hear. But when you're trying to be expressive, and you're trying to shape a sound and get some complexity into it, and that, you know, that's all you're doing. You're on stage and everybody's listening to you, you know, playing that sound. The sound is very different, and the feeling is different. And I should be able to tell you why that is, but I really can't. I can just note that it's true, and you know, some people are aware of it, and other people are not. Especially this business about, you know, the feeling. The waveforms in here are made continuously, just like, you know, a vibration of a string or an air column. And the filters and the amplifiers operate on those sounds continuously. And the sort of control that I, as a designer, have over, you know, how the sound is shaped and distorted, modified as it goes through, is a different sort of control than you have when you're writing software to generate sounds. So that's just about the sound quality and about the experience of playing an analog instrument. The bottom line for you know, for musicians who get into something like this Voyager here is that very soon after you begin to explore sound, you begin to get a feeling. It's not a feeling in any one specific part of your body. It's not, you know, it's nothing wild and crazy, but it's a feeling of making contact, of what you're doing being natural somehow, or flowing easily. And part of that has to do with you know, what I can describe on a schematic diagram or on a graph of a waveform. And part of it has to do with something that I don't know how to describe at all now. There's just, you know, what goes on, what we're aware of in our experience is not all in our head. A lot of it is in our head. Some of it is outside of our head. There's a field out here that we don't know how to describe. We don't know how, you know, to prove it's there. But most of us, especially if you're a musician,
you know what I'm talking about. And you know, my experience is that field out here somehow interacts with analog stuff in a, at least let's be objective, in a different way than it interacts with digital.
You got the sound of the Curtis chips?
Funny you should ask that. I saw Doug Curtis last night. Yeah. he showed up. They're out there.
I use a lot of my influence over on
Cambridge. Yeah, for a while there, from the mid, for a while in the mid-70s, we all used it.
Yeah.
You know, the memory mode, full of Curtis chips.
Yeah.
All the early sequential stuff is Curtis chips. Curtis chips aren't available anymore. You know, unless you buy a huge number of them. But I find that there are no Curtis chips in there.
I was just wondering if you're talking about the sound.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they're okay. They're better than a digital emulation. I'd say that. You know, I've done the best I can using discrete analog stuff. And this sounds different from a Curtis chip. A little bit, but different. You can decide whether it sounds different. You know what the right answer is.
I was just wondering if there was a, possibly a feature or a trick on one of your creations that you might know about that your average person wouldn't, because it was just something that you maybe tucked in there for your own. Fancy, or you know, alternatively, if you don't have the, so if something like that doesn't come to mind, is there a feature on one of your pieces here that most people are overlooked, that is something we might be missing?
Gosh, I don't think so. I mean, what these instruments do, from the simplest Mogrophone up to the Voyager. Is all out there on the front paneling, and you can describe on a few sheets of paper what they do, how you use them, you know, what you do to get the sounds is open-ended. There are so many possible combinations that I can't begin to name them all. And really, it's our customers, it's the musicians who find all these things. I don't spend all that much time, you know, finding clever things to do with this stuff. I do the opposite. I try to make it as obvious, what they do as obvious as possible. Yes?
Do you have any good stories about you and John Cage?
The question is, do I have any stories about me and John Cage? We did some work for John Cage in 1965 for the performance of his Variations 5 in Lincoln Center. And what he wanted, the performance consisted of John Cage and a whole bunch of other musicians, of which I was one, and the Merce Cunningham dancers. And he wanted there to be several theremin-like antennas on the stage that the dancers could dance around and change the sound. So we built 12 antennas that were about 5 feet high. And they sat in a wood base that was about 15 inches or 18 inches in diameter. And then there was a wire that was taped to the stage, you know, carrying a control voltage that could then go to the modular stuff we had at the time.
or to turn things on and off with. So each one of these bases had electronics in it, theremin electronics. And we didn't have time to make actual proper printed circuit boards, so we were going to wire them by hand using perforated plastic boards with little terminals that you just stuck in and then soldered the parts to. So we ordered a whole big bag of these little terminals, and as we got into it, we discovered that they were defective, that the plating on them didn't allow the solder to stick properly. And there was not enough time to start over, so we were constantly repairing these things, and nothing worked right. And Cage chewed my ass, is what he did. He said, you have to stay up and fix these things as long as it takes. Because when I'm preparing for the things, I take 20-minute naps. You have to do the same thing. And this was right around the time when I was trying to finish my thesis, and right in the middle of this, my advisor called up and right in the middle of it, he called up one night at 9 o'clock and he said to me, "Moog, whatever is not on my desk by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning is not going in the thesis. Good night." And and here John Cage is telling me to sit up, these things and buy it. It was pretty tough. From time to time, during those couple of months getting ready for Variations 5, I was wondering who's going to notice the difference anyhow, because there was so much stuff, and a lot of it was, it appeared to be random. Maybe I could cheat and, just not worry about that everything was working. But the people at Bell Labs, Max Matthews himself, in fact, had built a 90-input mixer for all the stuff that was on stage. And by the time the performance came around, the stage was covered with this bunch of cables and patch cords that was about 6 inches thick. And let me tell you, that's a weird feeling, to walk on this thick carpet of patch cords and cables, so it's like quicksand, especially when you're tired, So the performance went on. I was up there on stage. As I remember it, I had some modules that we built, doing some patching, trying to get the outputs of the antennas to do something interesting. And other people up there were fooling around with radios. There were radios up there. There were all sorts of things that made funny sounds. And somehow the dancers turned some of it on and off as they moved around on the stage. The one thing I remember most clearly about that performance was it was all over. This is Lincoln Center, okay? Big.
How many people were in the audience?
Oh, a couple thousand, yeah. I mean, it was, as we used to say in Central New York, it was pretty deep shit. It was, everybody was very impressed with themselves that they were there. And the performance is over, everybody claps, and the lights go on and people file out. And here's this mess of cables, and we all begin picking the cables up. And about a half an hour into it, when just about everybody was out, this young couple came up to me. And they were all very happy to be there, smiling. And the guy says to me, "Mr. Pogue, I noticed that one of the dancers tripped over one of the cables. Did that make any difference?" And his girlfriend or wife said to him, "It was twice, dear." I felt like banging my head on the floor. I didn't have anything to do with John Cage after that. But it was quite an experience. I got to go out to his house and see the group of people that formed his little compound of really creative people. One of his neighbors was a sculptress, and she had this huge piece of aircraft runway material. You know, it's perforated steel with holes in it about this big. She had this thing sticking up in the air. It was about 12 or 14 feet long. There were wine bottles stuck in it, so when the wind blew past, all the wine bottles sang. And I thought that was the neatest thing in the world. I mean, for a nerdy engineer, that was really interesting.
Have you been out to see the wave organ out in Norway?
I haven't, no.
Have you heard about it?
No.
It's a similar sort of thing, but the water going in and out activates the tubes. And you can sit out there and listen.
What can I show you about some of this here?
All of it.
What's going through here? Let's begin here.
I have my iPod hooked up. Just run some music here. Okay. Run some Alice Coltrane. So we got them wired just from left to right.
Okay. So we get a little
more volume.
One here is a low-pass filter. A little bit hard to hear what it's doing. Low-pass filter is probably the most distinctive effect to come out of the early synthesizer modules. It just lets through the lower harmonics and cuts out the ones above it. Control here called resonance, which changes the shape of the response of this so that it emphasizes a band of harmonics. So it makes it. I think I'll show you more about this filter on the Voyager when I get there.
Shut it off for a minute. Let's give the ring modulator a try. That one's always fun. Technically, what the ring modulator is fairly simple. You have two signals going in, and what the ring modulator changes the amplitude of one in response to the waveform of the other. In purely technical terms, it's a four quadrant multiplier. But that's not how you describe the sound. In doing this, it creates additional frequencies that are above and below the signal you're feeding through, different pitches. You're going to hear one of the inputs of the ring modulator now is going very slow, this fast. And you're going to hear the signal from the iPod getting stronger and weaker at that rate. That's very, very slow ring modulation. I'll speed it up a little bit now. But at this speed, it's a very nice tremolo. As I speed it up now, it's going to go from being a tremolo to these additional frequencies called sidebands are going to start to separate audibly. It's going to get what is more generally associated with a ring modulator. If you're just playing one instrument through here, a guitar, a bass, or even a theremin, it's a lot clearer to hear. The effect is more dramatic. Here, especially with the cymbals, it doesn't do too much cymbals because cymbals have so many frequencies across the audio spectrum that if you add a few more, you know, it doesn't make that much difference. see what else we can play here. This is a tall sage phaser. This has two outputs. One is connected now. If we had the two outputs connected, you would hear part of the spectrum in one speaker and the other part in the other speaker. The effect would be a motion of a sound around like this between the two speakers. With one speaker, you don't quite get that. Here I've turned the LFO on, which sweeps the phaser effect back and forth. This is the MRF, the multiple resonance filter, our latest Mogafoger. And it's a completely new effect. How many of you have had a chance to play with it? How many of you haven't? It's a different level of complexity than the first three here. It consists of eight resonant filters. There they are, and you can hear each one is about a half an octave wide. Too much symbols.
Okay. Let's see.
Here are the bands, 200, 300, 4, 6. The first thing you can do is just play these bands by hand, if you like, flipping them in and out. It's not that much different from a graphic equalizer, but that's not what the MRF is designed to do. Here's
That envelope you hear is an envelope being applied to the to an individual filter section. If I turn up more than one. So what you get is superimposed upon whatever you're playing, and it's a lot easier to hear if the tone were a steady tone. Is this repeating pattern that you can then play in a variety of ways, either from the knobs or from the expression pedal. You can control the speed. Hear this faster and slower. Here we're changing the envelope. I can select the pattern. I'm not sure exactly where the distortion is coming from. But there's a mix control here that enables you to go from a straight through signal, this one, to all the way through the this is all the sound now is through the Lopez resonant filter. What I'm wondering is how about could I get a chord to go from the output here to I'm just getting myself confused about what we're hearing here.
Just a single cable, mono?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Okay, so here's a steady note. Easier to hear with interruptions.
We're just wondering what's going through it.
Okay. Now I can show you. Okay. Here are the individual filters. Notice there are two outputs on the MRF. The even number filters go to one output, the odd number filters go to the other output. So if you're using the two outputs, the sounds bounce around, which is really nice. If you only use one output, then they all come out better. and I'll slow it down a little bit. Is a variation in envelope shapes. This is all on one control now. You're going from, you know, very percussive short envelopes to changes that where the spectrum is constantly changing, but you don't get any strong sense of rhythm. So there are three things here that you can plug an expression pedal into. The speed. Let me put this in the middle. Okay, this is the slowest. Okay, you can play that. That's the same thing as the rate knob. This is mixed. Now it's a little bit better balanced. And the other one is the envelope shape. And if you wanted to, you could play all these things together. By the way, this sort of control is available on all the modal programs. That's one of the things that is a property of the entire line. That the main performance controls on here can also be controlled from an expression pedal or from an external control voltage anywhere. So let's go back. Now we can hear the a little bit more clearly what the patterns are. A total of 24 choices of patterns. In the second bank of 12, a lot of them have an additional modulation of vibrato modulation of the resonant frequency of these resonances. So you get this sort of shimmering effect.
Can you control the amount of that?
No. We ran out of controls. Huh? there's also a tap input here with a regular foot switch, a normally closed foot switch.
In the speed? Front speed of it?
Yeah.
Tap tempo.
You can tap in the tempo of it.
Oh, wow.
And with a very simple adapter plugging into the tap tempo, you can also step through steps one at a time rather than having them go according to the pattern.
Can you clock the MIRF from another synthesizer?
Like yes.
If the Voyager is connected to the computer, it'll be like the computer's clock going into the MIRF?
Yeah. The best way to do that is with the adapter that would convert it from tap into step, and then if you have an external gate, you know, from MIDI or something like that, you use that to tap it through. So yes, it can be synchronized to any gate signal you have.
Are you planning on developing another delay? Why did you stop the production of the delay? Because a lot of people ask about the delay.
Yeah.
It's selling for close to $1,000 on eBay.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I designed the delay back, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, 5 years ago. And we ordered a bunch of the delay chips from Panasonic. Panasonic was the only manufacturer of these things. And you order them right from Panasonic. Okay, that's not important. The important thing is that Panasonic makes them, whether we got from Digi-Key or, we place the order. About a month later, place the order, we said, okay, the message back, the acknowledgement back we got is that Panasonic is going to do their last run. So we ordered a bunch, And we were waiting for the day to come when they were shipped. And the day came and went, and then we got a message, the last run failed. And Panasonic would not be shipping anymore. So we said, and we canceled our plans to go into production. And I didn't think it was going to be any big deal. We hadn't shipped a one. Hadn't made a one at all. Shipped a one. So we announced plans to cancel this. This is after we'd shown it at a couple of NAMM shows. And we got this howl of protest from people. You can't do that. So the guy who buys parts for us in the company went out, and there are what are called brokers all over the world, guys who find little stashes of parts here and there, manufacturer will liquidate a stock of this or that, and then the broker will buy it up and resell it at a much higher price. And we got enough to make 1,000 units. And we said, okay, that's it. We'll make those 1,000. That'll be it. I think it was a surprise to all of us how well it was received. We like the way it sounds.
Sounds amazing.
So we would like to, we can't make any more of these now because we can't, the few remaining delay chips that are out there in various stashes around the world are ridiculous prices. We're we would like to make another delay. We don't want to make another delay that's going to sound any worse, any less good than the MF 104. And when we figure out how to do that, we may come out with one. It won't be all analog because there are no more analog delay chips.
Do you have any plans for any larger synthesizers?
No. Our plans now are to introduce a rack-mount version of this early next year. After that, we won't be. After that, we don't have plans.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say we won't be, but.
Are you going to continue to make Mogrifogers to complement the Voyager?
What do you mean by that? I mean, how?
Well, I'm thinking more of building up a modular system,
yeah,
using the Voyager as the.
The Voyager and the Mogrifogers are all compatible.
Mm-hmm.
The control inputs to these Mogrifogers are, the same voltage range as the control outputs from the Voyager thing.
Mm-hmm.
So any additional Mogrifogers that we make will also have that compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any questions I can answer about the Voyager? This is your chance. Yeah.
Are there any plans for a Voyager with aftertouch?
Well, this has aftertouch.
The newer one?
The older.
No.
Yeah. You have to program it in. But it's the keyboard does have aftertouch. Yeah.
I have an issue with my Voyager when I'm sequencing something that's faster than a quarter note.
Yeah.
It won't react. Like the MIDI won't react. It just acts erratic. It's not like that. It's more like that. You know. And I did the software upgrade, but that hasn't changed the way that the MIDI reacts.
I don't remember seeing that problem. If you'll, if you let me have your name, email address, I'll check into it and see if our service guy recognizes it or if I can identify it. It doesn't sound familiar to me, so I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it's weird. Sometimes it'll do it,
yeah,
the right way. It'll trigger the eighth notes properly or anything faster than eighth note, but then sometimes it just
it should be okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, well.
Is that at any tempo?
At any tempo, yeah. And the values of the notes, I cut it to just like the perfect eighth note in the MIDI,
yeah,
but it's still.
So you can do like twice the tempo and put an eighth note.
Yeah. And then I sequenced it at 16th notes with an electrode or something, and it responded perfectly. But when it's cutting out of the computer, it's weird.
Sounds like it might be a soft. What software are you running?
Pro Tools LE.
Pro Tools LE. Sounds like it might be on the software end rather than the electrode sequencing it fine.
I mean, I've sequenced other hardware with Pro Tools, and it's fine. It's just that one little glitch that I got with Voyager.
We kind of had Bob scheduled from 3 to 5, so I just, and he's got a busy night, so I just want to kind of wrap this up. He actually has some, at some point soon, he has some photographs that are there for him to sign and a couple other things. So if you guys just, I just don't want him to feel like questions are coming on and on. So
Regarding the digital analog nature of the Voyager, has there been any I'm one of the few people that could actually deal with things like the updating of the encoders, that sort of thing, the real subtle movements. Has anybody asked or has there been any discussion about the possibility of a reduced function set Voyager? In other words, something which is purely analog just loses the patchability, the programmability, but maintains the new module and front panel set. Did I make that clear? I'm not sure.
Retains the new...
In other words, an instrument which is the Voyager, but without the... but it's like a direct connection. In other words, potentiometers that directly hook up to the modules and bypasses digital entirely.
We haven't talked about that specific thing. It's an interesting idea. What we're talking about here is that because the entire front panel is stored in the memory here for instant recall, that's how you can go from one patch to the other, the front panel knobs have to be digitized and then turned back into analog voltages. That happens 300 times a second, which is pretty fast, but on some things, you know, like you can hear a little bit on the cutoff frequency. If you turn the knob fast, you can hear those steps every now and then. By getting rid of the patch storage capability, you could go right from the knobs to the analog circuits. It would be completely smooth. So.
But of course, the downside is then you'd lose the programmability and lose a lot of real time.
You can't have both.
Sequence are based on interaction, so it turned into more like a real mini mode.
Yes.
Save your patches on pieces of paper.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I missed that.
Or glue the knobs in place like Franklin did. Yeah.
Excuse me. On your pedals, if you're using those with guitar, and like the input signal, is that consistent with what's coming out of your keyboard, like voltage, all that? You can affect it the same way a keyboard would. The strength of the signal from like a guitar opposed to
There's a drive control on all of these,
right?
And you can adjust the level going in so that it's, you know, it's what it should be. There's a level, an LED here for adjusting the level on all of them. You just simply turn the drive up. You know, if you have a low signal coming out of your guitar, you turn the drive up a little bit more.
How much gain does it provide?
It's over 30 to 1 range. Something as small as 60 millivolts, audio going in, which is about one tenth what a guitar provides. if you turn the drive all the way up, a 60 millivolt signal will drive the whole thing.
Is there anything on the guitar horizon? Specific to guitar.
You know, we don't plan all that detail in advance. We know the next couple of products we're going to do. Try to keep focus on those because what people want seems to change so quickly. We'd like to be able to respond to that. So, we're doing a rack mount Voyager now. Looking into one or two other things. After the NAMM show in January, we'll begin on our next round of new product development. And at that time, we'll check with all you good musicians, see what's in your heart of hearts. You know, I could design anything, but only one at a time.
Other plans for...
I can design anything I can design. I can't design everything.
Are any more Mogapoker plans in the future? Anything else?
We've talked about several things.
Yeah.
we have an idea for a distortion unit that operates over a much wider range and with more flexibility than the usual stuff. We talked to a lot of people have asked us about an additional delay unit. But there are all sorts of things to get into. If I say we're thinking about things, the next thing I know is you're going to tell your friend that Bob Bogue says that's what's coming out. And I have to watch out not to give you the wrong idea. Most of the things we think about, don't get done. Because it's a lot easier to think about something than to do it.
Do it.
Yeah. Hey, well, we want to thank you for coming down and talking to us. And I'm just going to be signing some pictures here, so if you guys are into that. But I think he's got a lot of stuff to do tonight, so I want to wrap it up and not keep him here. So thanks.
Photo. Let's see if does anybody have a white pen or a silver pen?
White or a silver pen?
I might have one in my
t-shirt. You might have one back.